Blog Talk Radio.
Of the Story Blender, hosted by our author Stephen James. Coming to you tonight, Stephen has a fabulous guest, an editor from Writer's Digest, Jessica Strausser, sure to have some excellent ideas on the craft of writing and storytelling excellence. She's a novelist herself. She shares insights gained from sitting in the editor's chair and from a writer's perspective. First, we also want to let you know that all the shows here on Suspense Radio, including The Story Blender, Crime and Science Radio, Inside Edition, and more, are all brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on all their published work, upcoming, and, of course, what they got in the archives. Check them out, kensingtonbooks.com. If you have any questions about the show or you just want to comment, you can always email radio@suspensemagazine.com. Put in the subject line whether the name of the host of the show that you want to know more about, and we'll make sure we get it over to them. So, Stephen, are you ready to take it away? Because now, here you go, The Story Blender with Stephen James and guest Jessica Strausser.
Welcome to The Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Susan May Warren.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And I'm really excited today about our guest because I met her at Thriller Fest a number of years ago, and she is the editor at a Writer's Digest magazine, which is really, I would say, the premier writing magazine here in North America. And so Jessica has been with the magazine for 10 years. She's also studied journalism. And I remember the first year that I met her at Thriller Fest, she was like looking for writers, and I ended up being able to connect with her. And so I've been able to write for Writer's Digest for a number of years. And so, Jessica, we really appreciate your time coming here. She's also, by the way, just signed a 2-book deal for some novels that she'll be writing. And so she comes to us as both an editor and a writer. So, Jessica Strausser, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's definitely been a pleasure working with you and having you as one of our most trusted regular contributors to the magazine over the years. So, cool. It's nice to have a chance to talk with you kind of more informally in this format, too.
Nice. Well, thank you very much. I remember, it's interesting, back in the day, like, I think even before you were at Writer's Digest, I did an article for them, and it was called, like, All of the Bad Writing Advice You've Ever Heard and Why Not to Believe It, or something like that. And so I was at this writer's conference. I think this was maybe 2001 or two, and someone was talking to me, and I said, yeah, I just did this article for Writer's Digest. Now, I wasn't a contributing editor at the time, but I had sold this article. And so this lady said, what? I said, yeah, I just did this article on bad writing advice. And this woman said, for Writer's Digest? I said, yeah, for Writer's Digest. She goes, I thought you had to be good to write for them. So
that's fantastic.
That was my first experience of finding out, oh, interesting. There will always be people out there to help you feel humble in this writing gig.
No doubt. I love a backhanded compliment, you know.
Right.
Writers,
right.
I guess we'll take compliments any way we can get them.
Yeah, that was great.
But yeah, Writer's Digest has been around since 1920, actually. And I think we are the number one, well, I know we are the number one publication for writers in North America. So it's definitely it's really something that all of us here are writers in different capacities. I think I'm the only active fiction writer on staff, but we have really active freelance writers. We have some people who have published nonfiction books. Our poetry editor of Poets Market, Robert Lee Brewer, has published a collection of poetry. And so we all are sort of part of our audience, which we think helps us, you know, better serve our audience. So it's not a responsibility we take lightly, but it's definitely a labor of love for everyone here, and we take a lot of pride in it.
Well, truthfully, you know, as I've looked at both resources online, but also magazines and books, I do keep coming back to Writer's Digest. I'm like, man, this stuff is really, really good. And not just the stuff I write. The other stuff isn't so bad either.
Well, you do have to be good to write for Writer's Digest.
So, over the course of your years, you've worked with Writer's Digest for a decade at least. And over that time, I know you've worked with dozens, probably hundreds of articles on story craft, storytelling, and I think that's an awesome perspective to be able to bring to the show, because we're always looking, a lot of people who listen are writers or fans of writing, readers and so on, and what are some of the aspects of writing that you think people are not teaching or that maybe haven't been covered as much as they should be, kind of in the literature that's out there right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd definitely say it's hundreds of articles at this point that I have edited on the craft of writing, let alone how many I've read, and dozens of books on storytelling, including your excellent book, Steve. and I think with that kind of volume, truth be told, I rarely can think of an aspect that someone isn't covering until they pitch it to me. So, in fact, if anyone listening knows of an aspect someone isn't teaching, please pitch it to me. I want to have that in the magazine. But I think something that I've learned in the course of reading and editing so many articles, I was sort of literally editing these articles by day and then writing myself by night, as I've been doing for years now, is that I think you might not be really able to absorb a certain lesson until you need it. And you don't always need what you need when you need it. So, you know, so much has been made about whether or not writing can even be taught at all. There are still people out there who say, you know, there's a whole camp of writers who say, if you want to write novels or memoirs or whatever you want to write, read that and then get your butt in the chair and write one. And I, of course, don't think that writing instruction should be bypassed. I think unquestionably a certain element of it can be taught. But I also think that the writers in that camp have a point in that the lesson means more if you already have a work in progress that you can immediately apply it to. It's kind of like when you learned a new word back in school, your teacher would make you use it in a sentence. And I think writing techniques are that way. You might read about a new writing technique, but the lesson probably isn't going to really stick until you have a chance to apply that. And so for me, I think the benefit has been, and the benefit that I've seen to our longtime subscribers and longtime readers and people who are constantly studying the craft of writing, is just that you never know what lesson you're going to need until you come across it and suddenly have a way. I mean, there will be times where I'm struggling with a certain character or whatever in my work in progress, and then I've already edited dozens of articles on character, but the one I happen to be reading the next day just says something that just applies to my current situation, and then you finally sort of get it, you know? So I think the real mistake that people make is thinking, well, I've read, you know, 5 leading books on the craft, I'm kind of schooled now, and then they sort of stop reading about the craft and just go on with writing. I think the reason that you should continue to keep reading about the craft and listening to shows like this one, going to conferences and continuing to learn about the craft, is because you never know when those lessons are going to apply. And it really is, it's one thing to kind of learn these lofty techniques, and it's another to have a work in progress that you can apply them to.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. I remember for me there was this time where people had talked about like cause and effect in stories and how one thing has to follow the next like this. And I was like, okay, whatever, I don't really get it. And I read these different books, and I just didn't get it. And then finally one day I was reading a book, and I was working on a novel, and I was just like, this light went on. I was like, causality, I finally get it. And I went through, and I mean, when I teach this at conferences, nobody is like, oh, wow, that. They all like, yeah, of course, that so makes sense. But like if you say, with a trembling hand, she reached out to lock the door. The killer was on the other side. You wouldn't write that because her reaching out doesn't cause the killer to be on the other side. You'd write, the killer was on the other side of the door. She reached out with a trembling hand to lock it. So one thing, then cause, instead of saying something, then explaining why it happened. And for me, I mean, it's so simple, but it transformed this one book I was working on. You know, every page I was like, am I saying something, then explaining why it happened, or am I rendering it moment by moment? I would never have gotten it if I wasn't actually working on a book at the time. And honestly, that was one of those moments, like you were talking about, Jessica, where it's like I'd read about stuff, but it was really putting it into practice where I finally understood it.
Yeah, I think for me, and this is Susie now, I think it's really important to always be honing your craft like that, because I'm the same way, Stephen. I get into a story, and I'm reading, and I'm working on it, and I feel like, what's missing? And, you know, maybe it's nothing is missing, but I then go read an article in Writer's Digest or some other craft book, and I think, ooh, I can add that layer. And it's not until I'm at that place in my story crafting that I realize how to add it. So, you know, if you don't keep learning, I think your writing kind of grows a little bit stagnant, and you always have to sort of keep pushing, especially in today's market where there's so many different options out there and different writing styles, right? So you always have to be upping your game. So I love that Jessica brought that up, that, you know, she's always, you know, we're looking for that. So the problem is that people can get into this pattern of kind of following this template for writing. And so how can templates be a good thing for writers, and how can we sort of break free of that and explore our own voice, do you think?
Well, you know, certainly some writers find templates very helpful and manage to use them to create something fresh every time. I sort of envy those people because I often feel that a template would save me a lot of rewriting, but it's just not really the way that I work. I think often people get into this debate between, you know, plotters and pantsers. The plotters being the people who go by the strict three-act structure, and the pantsers being people like Stephen. I actually prefer his term of organic writing to pantsing.
This is so funny because Susie and I go back and forth about this all the time.
Yeah, Stephen's organic. I'm an outliner. So you're
an outliner. Okay.
Yeah, but it's okay. It's okay. I accept organics as who they are and embrace them.
Well,
and, you know, so it's all good.
I think most people think you're either or. I think I'm a little bit of both, but I wish I could learn to be more of a plotter. But I think, you know, what the debate really boils down to, either it works for you or it doesn't.
Right.
But I also think, you know, sometimes something that works for you only works for you until it doesn't. So sometimes the magic can go out of something, especially when a template is followed too closely. I actually, I recently worked with a writer named Jeffrey Summers on an article regarding an approach I saw him speak about at last summer's Writer's Digest conference in New York City. And he calls his approach plantsing, which is a combination of plotting and pantsing. This article, I don't want to steal his thunder. It hasn't published yet. It'll be in our May-June issue. But his idea is basically that you do one until it works, and then when it stops working, you switch to the other. So if you feel better having your outline plotted out, that's fine. But, you know, when it starts to feel like, you know, the magic has gone out of it, or maybe things aren't progressing the way you thought, kind of throw it to the side, try just pantsing from that point on, see if you can get your footing, and then switch back if you want. I think the only danger in that approach is that it relies on you as the writer to recognize when something isn't working, and we can't always see that in our own work when we're very close to it. So I really think that's hard. It's interesting. Another aspect of my job that so inspires me, and that really is probably my favorite thing about it, is that I often do the interviews with best-selling authors for our cover stories for every issue. And one of the most prolific writers I've ever interviewed was a writer by the name of Susan Mallory. She's a romance writer, but she also writes, she started out as a romance writer, and now she also writes women's fiction, these book club books that book clubs love, and she started out as a very prolific romance, very prolific kind of mid-list romance writer, and now her women's fiction generally hits the New York Times bestseller list, but she still is writing those romance books too. Her novels, I think it's literally something like 150 novels that the woman has written. It's insane.
A lot of novels.
Yeah, that's crazy. She's a great writer. I read her. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she is a writer who grew up in California and grew up studying script writing, which is something that a lot of plotters talk about a lot, you know, because script writing has a regimented the three-act structure, but also it's a very disciplined kind of writing that relies so heavily on action and dialogue. And so Susan said that her approach from the start was really to make her strength, or to make her weakness a strength. So she said she always thought plotting was her weakness. So she would just study plotting. And she said, you know, we all kind of have these things that we know we're inherently good at, whether it's character or theme. And she said, if you can just concentrate on your weakness, if you can make that your good thing, you're golden. So she's kind of this, and she's someone that you might think of as a more, since she studied script writing, and because she writes so many novels a year, you might think that she is she would be a templated writer, that she would have this template that she follows, you know, for a romance, especially, maybe not so much for women's fiction. But she actually said, she's very reliant on structure, but she also was the quickest to point out that she is a lifelong student of the craft. And she said, if I am speaking at a writer's conference, you will find me in the seminars when I am not speaking.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, 150 novels later, she's speaking at a writer's conference. She is in those seminars studying the craft, trying to learn new things. And so I think that that is how you be successful if you are strictly following a structure, is to continue to find ways to challenge yourself, to continue to study the craft, to make your weaknesses your strengths, I guess.
Yeah. That's great. That's very inspiring. I really feel like that's a great one key tool that every author can take is just keep learning, right? Just keep going forward and trying different techniques, and that's fantastic.
I just love
when you were
talking
about
writers who. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I love talking to writers who you can tell really love it. You know, I think there are probably so many people out there who would say, 150, I think I'm done, or I think I'm going to slow down, you know, maybe just do one a year from here on out. But it's David Baldacci is the same way. I interviewed him just for our November-December issue, which is on newsstands now, and he is so prolific, but he just loves it. And those are the writers who I think we all would do well to pay attention to, because it's passion that's driving them. It's not that they've figured out how to use a template and they're using it as much as they can. It's that they just love storytelling.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was in touch with Dean Koontz a couple of years ago, and so we were writing back and forth about maybe doing an endorsement for one of my books, and he said, well, I'd love to look at it, but I can't right now because for the next 10 days I'll be editing and writing for 20 hours a day trying to finish a deadline. And I'm like, this is Dean Koontz, like, why do you need to work 20 hours a day for 10 days? I mean, it's like you've written so many books and, you know, but again, he's just so committed to storytelling that he's still going to put in that kind of time. It's amazing.
No, that's great.
And to get that kind of deadline, too, you know, you would think his publisher would just say, you know, whenever it's ready, Dean, just send it to us and we'll print it. You know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think deadlines are good for writers because people like me, I'll polish till the day is long. You know, it's like, oh, okay, now you have to turn your book in. Deadline. Oh, okay. You know, I'll keep, and I'm actually terrible. I'll like finish a book and then I'll go through and write it, you know, rewrite it, and then I'll polish it, and then I'll be like, oh no, I need to tweak that, and you know, like scenes will come to me in the middle of the night that I'm like, oh no, I need to add that, and then somehow the book starts to get sort of distorted and skewed, and so my editor said to me, listen, just send it in at that point because we don't want you actually working on it until we've seen it. So I start adding stuff that doesn't need to be added, you know. So deadlines can be a good thing for the obsessive compulsive that can't, you know, stop working on it. So
what about people who don't have a contract? Do you suggest that they set a deadline themselves, you know, just to say by this day I have to finish the book, or how, if you don't have a contract, how do you know at what point to stop?
Oh gosh, okay.
I don't know. Either one of you guys have any ideas?
Susan started it.
Yeah, sorry, that was my problem. That was my fault. I don't know. So maybe when the story's over. Like I don't know the answer to that because I'm the worst. I'll be thinking of scenes that I can insert long after the book is published. You know, I'll be like, oh, I'll just add this sort of deleted scene that wasn't really deleted but that I really wanted to put in there. You know.
Maybe I'll put it on the website. It can be
right, extra material. Yeah. Hey, look at this, the scene that should have been, you know. Maybe I can write my own fan fiction.
I actually have people do that, even just with magazine articles. Sometimes I'll come in the morning and I'll have like four or five emails from the same person. And it's like, you know, 6:30 PM. Here's the article. It's due tomorrow. Hope you like it. 8:24. Just caught a couple typos. Here's the article again. Then it escalates to the like 3:15 AM. Okay, I had to add. Now I'm 700 words over word count, but I really think it's good now.
Okay, Jessica, that's sad because that's totally me. My editor, by the time I turn it in from 5 p.m. till the next morning at, you know, 7 a.m., I've sent her 12 drafts. Oh, no, just this one. Oh, just this extra one. And, yes, that's totally me. So I really feel the pain of those people because it's always like as soon as you're done, that's when all the good stuff comes. So frustrating.
Right, right.
So maybe we need like a fake deadline and then a real deadline. You know, like we turn it in and we're like, oh, we're faking ourselves out, and then we're like, ooh, and then we can still do it. So, I don't know.
Just email it to yourself and pretend you're emailing it to your editor.
Right. I like it. They should just bounce the first 10 emails that they get from me, and then next one.
So. I mean, people sometimes ask me, how do you know when a book is done? And honestly, when I can't improve it anymore, has been my answer.
Mm-hmm. It's a good answer.
And yeah, I don't know if that's, you know, the right answer or not, but it's like if I notice things that could be improved, and why wouldn't I improve them, you know? So
right.
Yeah, so it's hard for me, but I actually do work under deadlines all the time and try to meet them the best I can. But one thing I was thinking of, when you were talking about the other author, Jessica, earlier, who has written so many novels, just the idea of voice, and it's not something we talk about a ton on here, but every author has kind of their own unique voice. I know I've talked to, I was at a bookstore, and they said, oh, even if you didn't put your name on a book or had a different title, we would still, after one page, be able to tell it was a Stephen James book. And I'm like, that's crazy. I must have a very, very like distinctive or easy to recognize voice in my novels. And do you think that voice is genre specific, or does it go more author specific? What's your thought on that?
You know, it's so interesting now because I feel like a lot of the books that have been sort of runaway bestsellers, if you will, over the past few years are really voicey kind of books, for lack of a better term. And Stephen, you're actually writing an article on this for me on changing POV throughout a story.
Yes, I think so. Do I have a deadline?
I think you have some time.
Oh, my.
But I should be asking you this question because, no, I think that is, it seems like lately, not that writers should never write to trends is the first thing any agent would ever tell you, because by the time you write to a trend, it's over. But something like voice, I don't think is necessarily a trend. And I think almost there is such a volume of books out there for people to read that it seems like if you can hit on something that's very unique and distinctive, whether it's distinctive to you or distinctive to a character, that readers are really drawn to that for some reason. I don't know that it's genre-specific. It could be author-specific, but I think some authors are brilliant in that they make every book sound almost as if it was written by somebody completely different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's... When you were working on your novels, was that something that was in your mind, like trying to find a specific voice, or were you more just interested and focused on the story and characters?
The novel that I did just sell to St. Martin's Press, it's called Almost Missed You. It's due for a release in early 2017, and I haven't revised it yet. I'm getting revision notes from my editor in the next couple of weeks, actually. But that book actually goes back and forth between three characters. So every chapter switches POV. And so definitely I thought for me, it came most into play in revising the book. I think if you're going to write a book like that, you sort of have to do, and I've talked to other authors who've used this approach too, where at some stage you have to kind of just pull out all of the chapters that are told in one character's voice and just revise those and make sure that those sound as consistent as you can and then pull out the other ones. So for me, a voice was huge in the novel that I just sold. It wasn't my first novel. I actually had a previous novel that a previous agent shopped and never sold. So I've kind of been through that trial and error stage that I know a lot of other writers go through. Definitely been through my share of rejection and things like that. So it's funny when you finally sell your novel and everyone calls it your first novel and it's really not your first novel. I know there are so many writers who it's like their ninth novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'm lucky that this is my second one that I actually got to the end of is going to be my first one. And then it is a two-book deal, so I'm working on the second book in my deal, which will actually be my third one. So,
awesome.
But I don't beware of anybody who has not yet published her first novel who is going to tell you about voice.
I was just thinking about my
astute writers and writing instructors out there.
Yeah, I was just thinking of my second novel came out, and one of the point of view characters is a teenage girl, and so I wrote this teenage girl point of view, and it's kind of a coming of age subplot or whatever. And so this one writer or reader sent me a note, and she's like, okay, I had to look you up because I thought you were probably a female writing under a male's name because she thought this like teenage girl was like so really rendered or whatever. And I'm like, well, I have three teenage girls at home, so
right.
It's probably why I sounded like a teenage girl, because I just tapped into my inner self and my inner dad or something like that.
Or you just listen to the conversation around you. And like, I had that happen when I wrote about brothers. I wrote a series and it had a number of brothers in it. My editor was like, oh my gosh, these sound just like brothers would be. And I'm like, well, I only have one brother, but I have a house full of boys. So all I had to do was like listen to what they were saying and how they treated each other. And it was, you know, and I kind of pulled that. So I think that, yeah, probably you probably the teenage girl thing just comes through into you. It's like by osmosis, right? It's just like you just hang out and all of a sudden it's there. So no, that's good, though. It means that you're listening.
I have two very small children, and one is only just now starting to talk. But even if you aren't writing about children, I feel like children are such gold mines of creativity and dialogue. And it's the things that you say. Sometimes if sometimes if you put it in a book, probably no one would believe it. But definitely my book had a child character in it, and it's not from his perspective, certainly, but just spending time with children of that age and listening to them is, I think it's really, you can kind of tune your ear. Stephen, your story was reminding me of that movie with Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets, where he's a male writer who writes from female perspectives. And he's actually not a nice person at all. Mm-hmm. That woman comes up to him in the elevator, I think it is, and says, "How do you write women so well?" And he says, "I take a man and I take away all sense." Something like super offensive.
Yeah, I remember that scene. I remember thinking, oh my goodness, it's terrible.
So you know, you don't necessarily have to, you just have to be a really good writer. It doesn't mean empathizing with the character exactly, but...
I was always amazed at the author of Memoirs of a Geisha, how he became a geisha. It was like so interesting how he actually got into this, you know, the POV of that character. And clearly you don't have to be a geisha to know how to write like one, but it was really interesting. So I thought that was a real masterful example of how to get into a POV that you're not familiar with.
Mm-hmm. We get that question a lot from people who are writing, you know, thrillers and mysteries especially. We have an agent advice column. We have an agent who writes, takes reader questions in the magazine, and that was a question that she got recently with someone who said, "You know, I'm writing about a serial killer. Obviously, I'm not going to go be a serial killer, but what are some things that you would have expected me to have done?" And she had some really practical tips, such as, you know, going to a shooting range and firing a weapon if the people in her book were going to be firing a weapon and things like that.
That is cool. That's a great idea.
Yeah, there was, I've written about some pretty dark characters, and like one time at church, this one lady came up to my wife and she goes, "Are you afraid to sleep with him?" Then she turns to me and she's like, "I am praying for you." She's like, "You need help. What is wrong with you?" And so people are like, "Well, how could you write this, like, scare, I don't know, this creepy character?" And I always just ask, what would this character naturally do? And then I just let him do it. And I think it touches on that believability factor, but also, you know, obviously I've never been a teenage girl or a serial killer. We probably, hopefully, won't be at any time. But but just to say, you know, what would this character naturally, you know, do? And I was in Switzerland just teaching a couple weeks ago, and so I was in this writing class. I was teaching fiction techniques, and I said, "Well, let's just say a teenage girl breaks up with her girlfriend, or a boyfriend. I mean, what might she do?" And people are like, "Well, maybe eat ice cream, or cry, or text, or change her status, or call her friend." I'm like, "Okay, so any of those could work. Let's just choose one." So, like, call her friend. So I was like, "All right, now she calls her friend, goes to talk to her friend. What could make things worse?" And then someone was like, "Well, what if her friend was the one that started going out with her boyfriend and broke him up?" And I'm like, "All right, why not? That sounds good." And then I was like, "How can we make things even worse in a way that's a twist?" And we're like, "What if she pulls out a knife and stabs her friend, then texts her friend, her boyfriend, from her friend's phone and says, 'I'm waiting for you, come to the house.'" And they're all looking at me, and I was like, "I don't know, I write thrillers, what do you expect from me?" And then I looked around and I was like, "But this is fun, isn't it?" And they're all like, "Yeah, this is really fun, this idea of asking questions and seeing a story emerge and trying to step into it." And it was really neat just to see all these people, you know, from Geneva just getting excited about the idea of crafting stories by asking questions.
I know another useful guide that I've heard a lot of writers talk about, specific to voice also, is having a very specific reader in mind when you're writing. And that's another thing. It's sort of like the pantsing and plotting. Some people say, you know, that they can't even think about anybody reading their work because it would just paralyze them with fear. And other people, it really helps them to think about a reader. But we talked about Susan Mallory, the prolific women's fiction author, earlier, and she told me she writes all of her books for the same woman. And it is a imagined woman who is her husband is out of town, and all of her kids are sick, and she has just had the most exhausting day, and she has put all of her kids in bed, and she has just made herself a bath and just wants to soak in the tub and read a book. And that is who she writes her stories for. And I feel like once in a while, if you feel like you're starting to lose the voice, that can be a helpful way to kind of anchor yourself, is to think about who it's for, too. Especially if you're not trying to do some wild character change from, you know, chapter to chapter, but you're just writing, you know, what are you writing? Is it a cozy mystery? Is it an edgy thriller? You know, what is that reader going to expect from this?
I love that. I love having a specific reader in mind. That is a fantastic idea, especially if you write different genres, right? You've got Stephen's genre, which is the scare you to death genre, and then you've got my genre, which is romance, you know, and my readers are clearly different than his. And so having, if I was to dive into Stephen's genre, which I would never do, I'd have to write for a different audience, right? So I'd have to figure out who that person was. So really like how she broke that down. I think that's super helpful for writers to figure out who am I writing to, you know, and then not being ashamed to just write for that, you know, because like I have people that say, well, do you have any male readers? Well, sure, I've got male readers, but 85-90% of my readers are women because I write romance. And yes, I write romantic adventure, but, you know, but it's okay. And, you know, and I've had people say, well, why don't you write more for the men? And I'm like, well, why should I do that? Because my readers are women, and it's men can go read Stephen's books. but I mean, you know, plenty of women read Stephen's books too. But it, you know, it's like don't be ashamed to write for that one reader and say I'm focusing on that because there's a lot of them out there. And that's a great trick. Great tool.
I feel like it's easier to focus on what it's more real to you if you're just choosing one person too, rather than I'm writing for all the people who fit this demographic. You know,
right.
Kind of think of one real person.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, really great idea. Really great idea.
I think I'll choose the lady who I was at a conference, and she came up, and she's like, oh, I am your biggest fan. Can you sign my book? She's like 75-year-old or 80-year-old woman. And so
wow.
I think I'll choose that as my specific. No, I'm just kidding. I was like, you're just not really who I have in mind when I sit down to write as, you know, the target reader for my books. But
isn't that cool?
But hey, fantastic.
Yeah, that's
cool.
Cool
to reach someone who's beyond what you would have imagined, you know?
Yeah, totally. I think that's you know, it's surprising, though. But you're right, you can't build your audience off of that one random person. Look, I have a man that always comes up to me and writes to me, and he says, oh, I love your latest book. I mean, he's like a rabid fan. But I have, you know, I mean, he's not the picture of all of my fans. He's just this one guy who happens to like romantic adventure, you know? So, yeah. So it's great that they like them, but you're right, that's not who I'm really writing for, so. But I'm glad they read.
Jessica, you've been working with fiction writing for years, really at Writer's Digest, and no trends necessarily, or you'll be behind the trend or whatever, but what would you say you've noticed as the emerging weaknesses in the writing that you're seeing, either, you know, in the books that you're maybe looking at reading or in the articles? I think every age kind of has certain weaknesses, and kind of have some ideas of what I think some of those are right now. The writing right now.
Stephen, can you check and make sure your connection is okay?
Did I not come through or something?
No,
yeah,
I lost probably most of that question. Could you hear it, Susan?
I didn't hear it either, but I thought it was just me. Sometimes I blank out. So, but he was basically saying there's, you know, you've studied for so long, you know so much of it, but you probably also know the weaknesses that many aspiring authors have. And what would you say is the biggest mistake or weaknesses that they make as they're starting out on their journey, or when they actually think that they've finished a book and are ready to publish it, but, you know, from our perspective, it might not be ready. What would you say is their biggest weaknesses?
Mm-hmm. I don't want anyone to feel daunted or discouraged. I think one of the most encouraging things that I know is that from a lot of, I don't see a lot of fiction manuscripts firsthand, certainly at the magazine. Although we have done things where we've done for a while we were doing little editor intensives where we would critique 50 pages of readers' manuscripts and things like that. We haven't been doing that as much lately, but I do talk to a lot of agents about what they see, and it's a question that you certainly ask them a lot. And I think the answer is really heartening, actually, because it seems like the volume of stuff that just misses the mark by a mile in their inboxes is much higher than you would imagine. And what editors and agents say to me a lot is that if people are reading Writer's Digest or studying writing, they can tell in their query or in their manuscript. And you're sort of already, if you're doing your homework, it's going to show, even if your manuscript isn't necessarily publishable or isn't necessarily strong. I think the weaknesses, the glaring weaknesses in their slush pile are people who just wake up one day and decide they're going to write a book and never, don't even look up how to write a query letter, just send them, you know, off-the-cuff stuff. You know, here's a 200,000-word romance, you know, something that's just missing the mark by a mile. So that's not helpful advice, in that everyone listening to this, hopefully if you're listening to this show, you already are studying storytelling or giving some serious thought to it. That's not helpful advice, but I think it's actually really encouraging advice. Because you think, you know, it, actually, agents tell us all the time, the number one way to stand out is just to follow the basics. So, you know, pay a lot of extra attention to your first 50 pages or your first three chapters, which is the partial that a lot of agents are going to ask you for if they like your query. Study how to, but don't stop at 50 pages and then let everything fall apart. But certainly, I mean, usually when we ask them for tips, the things that they tell us are very basic and are things that virtually anybody would pick up if they were to read up on how to write a query letter or how to prepare a submission. And so I actually have always sort of found that very heartening, that it's not, it might not be as difficult to stand out. I do think it's difficult to get published, but it's not as difficult to stand out, present yourself professionally, as you might think. In terms of weak manuscripts that are actually for sale on the bookshelves, I find those useful too. I think everybody probably has a different idea of what they are. I think publishing is really subjective and reading is very subjective. But if I'm reading a book and I'm thinking, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating, especially if you've been getting rejections for years. And we've all had that experience where you're reading something and you're thinking, geez, I could do better than this. I think that is great. Like, you don't want to read only bad novels, because then your writing probably would, you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to be able to raise yourself up to a certain level. But I think reading one of those once in a while actually kind of can light a fire under you, because you think, okay, if you can glaringly see the weaknesses in something, that can kind of motivate you to, if you're thinking, you know, I can do better than this, then go ahead and do better than that. Catherine Coulter, who's started out as a writer of romantic suspense, and now writes a lot of thrillers. I think it was Catherine Coulter. Or her whole writing career started by her throwing a book across the room, telling her husband she could do better than that. And he said, well, why don't you? She wasn't being serious. She was just frustrated with her reading experience. I don't know. I think weaknesses in manuscripts can be kind of inspiring, I guess, to other writers too, because it's, I don't know.
Am I cutting out anymore, or am I good here?
No, you're all good.
Fantastic, good.
Sorry about that.
No, I think those are great points, and also, you know, I tell people, get angry. I think you're absolutely right, Jessica, and it can be motivating to get angry at mediocrity and really let it motivate you to write great stories.
Yeah, you have to hold on to that desire to say, I'm going to write a great story. And, you know, it can be disheartening sometimes when you are reading and you're like, wow, that you know, especially for an aspiring author who isn't published yet, and then seeing people that are published that are maybe writing, you know, not upping their writing game as much as they could, you know, but at the end of the day, you have to be happy with what you've written. So if you're writing, if your only standard is to be better than them, well, maybe you need to take another look and say, wait, my standard is this because this isn't what I know I can write, and I'm not going to even look at the other competition. I'm going to write my very, very best, which is up here, you know, and because otherwise we can sit and compare ourselves to others, and good and bad. I always think it's good to read up, you know, because like mm-hmm. I try to read people that I consider to be better than me so I can learn. But you're right, having that, you know, reading down, you can kind of, it can ignite a fire to you. You just can't say, oh, well, then my writing is okay because I've written to this level. No, you've got
to
go to the next level.
Well, mine's certainly good enough. If this is good enough. Right.
Right.
Also, I think certain people sort of, I think once you, you know, it's harder to break in now. I don't know. I think, you know, at Writer's Digest, we're really about celebrating and respecting all kinds of writers and all kinds of storytelling. And that's sort of my personal philosophy, too. And I think there are a couple of successful writers in particular I'm thinking of who are sort of easy targets. And it never sits well with me when people tear them down as being not very good, because mm-hmm. obviously that writer is doing something right. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is actually probably quite difficult, even if it looks easy, mm-hmm. because making it look easy is part of the trick. Mm-hmm. And so what we should be doing is trying to figure out what they are doing right and mm-hmm. see if there's anything at all we can learn from it rather than turning up our nose at it.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
It's good. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's exactly
well,
right.
Well, Jessica, no, it's good. Thanks. Thanks for coming in. And it's been good to chat a little bit. We always end up emailing each other, but good to hear your voice mm-hmm. again. And obviously we want to encourage people to pick up Writer's Digest or maybe subscribe online. What's the best way to do that? Is it to go through the website or to order it through the mail?
You can click through at writersdigest.com or writersdigestshop.com. We do have print subscriptions. We publish 8 times a year, which is sort of an odd frequency, but we are available in all formats. You can get a Kindle subscription. You can get a Nook subscription. You can get a digital subscription where we will email it to your inbox as soon as it's ready every month. You can still get a print subscription. We're also on newsstands at Barnes & Noble and various other retailers. And we also have something, too, called the Writer's Digest VIP program, which we also publish the Writer's Market series of books, which for anyone who is interested in freelancing at all or who is submitting short stories or maybe submitting to agents, those books are, you know, they're annual guides that come out that are just lists of markets that are open to submissions. And they have a database, too, which is online, which is writersmarket.com. And you can buy a monthly or an annual subscription to writersmarket.com to access all these agents' listings or all these market listings for literary journals or magazines or virtually anything. And so we have actually, it's kind of a package deal where you can get Writer's Digest magazine and Writer's Market Writer's Market.com subscription and a Writer's Digest magazine subscription for a really deep discount compared to if you were going to buy them both separately. Mm. And that is only at the Writer's Digest shop, writersdigestshop.com, and it's called the Writer's Digest VIP program. And so if you get your 2 subscriptions rolled into one with that, you also get a discount on a ton of other products. Like, I think your orders on anything in the shop for the entire year, including products such as Stephen's book,
mm-hmm.
Story mm-hmm. Structure, and online writing workshops and webinars and everything. So actually, a lot of people don't know about that program, which is why I mention it, because a lot of people are buying those subscriptions separately and not realizing that you can roll them together and get the discount all year, too.
Hmm. That's great news.
Cool.
Yeah.
And what about you, Jessica? Is there a place people can follow you, your writing, maybe Twitter, Facebook?
I am on Twitter at Jessica Strauser, and I'm very active on Twitter. I mostly tweet writing tips and only occasional cute things that my kids say.
That sounds fair enough.
It's true. I'm a follower, and I love what you tweet. I'm always following. You did recently a bunch of old Writer's Digest covers, like from the 1950s or something, and it was interesting. Yeah, it was so cool. So if you're out there listening, follow her on Twitter. It's fantastic.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm very active on Twitter. I am working. Now that I'm going to be an author also, I do need a homepage. I need to follow my own advice and get a website.
Right.
So I'm working on that. But in the meantime, I blog on the blog called There Are No Rules at writersdigest.com.
All right. Good.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks. And thanks
so
to everybody for listening. And for info about my books, you can go to stephenjames.net.
And for my books and information about my story coaching, you can go to SusanMayWarren.com and LearnHowToWriteANovel.com.
And to check out more broadcasts, click to theStoryBlender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.